That's way back in our first summer, and the Holden Village Record School bears witness to the fun of that summer. And Laverne Reiki, who's chairman of our board, loved to flip chips from each other and have a good debate going all the time. This year, we had planned for Laverne to be here this week, but he couldn't come because he's acting dean at the University of Washington. Still refuses to take the office of dean, but he's doing the work and couldn't take the time off that he had to take. So we missed that kind of public debate because these two really enjoy very much when they're countered and when there can be actual live issues that are openly discussed. But we have enough writing. In fact, it's a little exciting while Art's here. Officially, he's here for a preaching clinic, and how we line that up, I don't know yet. Art and I will get together on it today and talk. I have a little money even from one of our insurance companies for that, Aid Association for Lutheran. So it's something we hope preachers will be interested in again, and that's preaching. And we thought one way to get it would be to have something stimulating going here.
I've seen many contrived devices to try to stop the authoritarianism of the preacher, but this is really the most effective I've ever seen. If I stand up, I can't see anybody. The title for today, Quest for Reality, really is the title of what I'll be talking about every day I am talking. I assume that that's everybody's quest. I assume that that's really what the whole turbulence today is all about. The quest for what's really real. That it lies behind the demythologizing that's going on both in society and in literature and in scripture. It describes what we mean by the generation gap. People are afraid of what's phony. They're not able to buy our language and our actions until they find out that what we say is really real, a quest for reality. Now, you can begin at all kinds of points at this. What's really real in one's own life, you can do it psychologically. What's really real theologically, you can do it as a theologian. I'd like to today just talk a little bit, and interrupt me or anytime you feel like. I'm a very poor group dynamics leader. I kind of forget the group and start talking and assume that everybody's fascinated with what I'm saying. So you'll have to interrupt me anytime you feel like. Now, the business of reality, quest for reality, is aptly discussed in that sermon that was handed out this morning, The Irrelevance of Christ. If you haven't read that, you must read it. It's beautifully done. And this whole business of symbol in reality that we were joking about. I have a feeling that we're looking for reality on a too superficial a basis. We're thinking that if we can change the form, we'll have changed the content. And I've always questioned that. I think that you can change the form in order to better look at the content, but reality is the content. For instance, what's really real? We rode for a long time, my family and I, in a car with a radio, and so the kids would turn on the local station, and they'd always have a way of judging whether the station was any good within 10 seconds. The station had a tone that they identified with or they didn't identify with. And if it had a tone that they identified with, they kept it on. And my wife and I had decided that this was our summer for togetherness, and so we'd listen to this stuff. Now, the amazing thing was that a song would come up, and I enjoy a lot of the contemporary music that the kids are singing, if I can understand it. So they'd sing a song. They'd come over the radio, and my wife and I would listen. We're all the same distance from the radio. We all have the same set of ears. Our hearing is pretty good. And after the song was over, I'd look at my wife, and she'd be as blank as I. We hadn't caught a word. And my kids had understood every word. I listened to one song. It's in the year 2525. The only way I got that was for my children to translate it sentence by sentence. It's a great song. Marvelous. It was sung 10 times, 10 different stations. Counted them. I still hadn't got the words. Now, is reality resident in a change of art form? Reality for them means a level at which they can relate, communicate, hear. But is that really all there is to reality? My point is that the reality is the content of the song. Not the change in tone, not the change in pronunciation, articulation, the whole new way of speaking that this age has. And it's this deeper sense of quest for reality, what's really real in life, that I'm interested in, and I assume you are. As we look for this reality, many of us of my generation feel that time is wiping out all that's really real. Then we listen to our kids and they say all that time is doing, this turbulence, is to eliminate the phony and to expose what's really real. And so you've got a great big theological debate brewing. What is God's reality? Is it that rock that's resisting the river, or is it the river that's trying to erode the rock? Rock of Ages, cleft for me, has suggested for some of our kids a kind of an irrelevance connected with Christianity, you know, something that is connected with yesterday. And as I read the Bible, I'm convinced that the Bible is talking about relevance as being always, always here. It's the river. It's the movement of time. The question really is anyone really contemporary? I'd suggest, as one man said, I heard him say last spring, one of our students came up with this one. He's probably Stone Age in his culture, medieval in his religion, Victorian in his moral behavior codes, that the only thing modern about man at all is plumbing and TV. What do we mean by reality? If, on the other hand, we indicate, we tip our hand, before we start, that we belong to a certain segment of time or culture or space, and even though we have our hand on what's real, and people say, now I know I'm going to have heard that before, I'm not going to listen, is that reality? It reminds me of a time when our youngest boy was only 3, and he was playing with imaginary playmates all the time, because there weren't none in our neighborhood. And they were Billy and Jimmy, whom we had for dinner and supper and all the time around the house. And one time I was sitting in my study and I heard my boy doing something that I knew was wrong. I'd forgotten what. So I called to him with a loud voice, Len, come here, I want to talk to you. And I heard him walk to the door of my study and stop. And I uttered this command again, and then I heard him say to Billy and Jimmy, Billy and Jimmy, you better sit down. When Dad talks this way, it means it's going to take a long time. Now, what was reality in the situation? He had it pegged on a certain level. I had it pegged on a different level, but there was a different reality that neither one of us had caught. And that was that the ultimate reality was how we were relating to each other. Well, as we search for this I think we find that the avenue, the area that is influencing us the most and maybe the most productive is in the area of the changing art forms today. Music, art. I'm particularly interested in literature. The change in art forms in literature. I've got a thing here that I've quoted before, and maybe some of you have heard me read it, but I like it. This is a beautiful example of how language communicates reality. I got this from the Manchester Guardian in England. As you know, the English style of communication is understatement in order that there be no emotional coloration of facts. And it's a beautiful example, this letter that I quoted. I'm going to quote of their clarity, simplicity, which thus leads to a dramatic effect. It's a letter from a workman to an employment agency, a compensation agency, for, you know, that pays insurance claims for injuries and so on. Here's the letter. Respected sir, when I got to the, he had been working as a bricklayer on the Barbados Islands. When I got to the building after the storm, I found that the hurricane had knocked some bricks off the top. So I rigged up a beam with a pulley at the top of the building and hoisted up a couple of barrels full of bricks. When I had fixed the building, there was a lot of brick left over. I hoisted the barrel back up again and secured the line at the bottom and then went up and filled the barrel with extra bricks. Then I went to the bottom and cast off the line. Unfortunately, the barrel of bricks was heavier than I was, and before I knew what was happening, the barrel started down, jerking me off the ground. I decided to hang on, and halfway up I met the barrel coming down and received a severe blow on the shoulder. I then continued to the top, banging my head against the beam and getting my finger jammed in the pulley. When the barrel hit the ground, it bursted its bottom, allowing all the bricks to spill out. I was heavier than the empty barrel, and so started down again at high speed. Halfway down, I met the barrel coming up. And I received severe injuries to my shin. When I hit the ground, I landed on the bricks, getting several painful cuts from the sharp edges. At this point, I must have lost my presence of mind because I let go of the line. The barrel then came down, giving me another heavy blow on the head and putting me in the hospital. All he wanted was some workman's compensation. Somehow I kind of like this sense of reality better than some of the explosiveness of our day. All right. Now, the way a writer does this is, like in this letter, is by the arrangement of his words. He understands that language is not a hurdle to reality, it's the very presence of reality. A writer believes that language does more than communicate, create a bridge. It actually creates, brings to pass that which is being written about. Now, we believe that when we say the Word became flesh. And a good writer really always believes about everything he writes that this Word becomes flesh. I would suggest that a preacher should believe that. A teacher should believe that. A parent should believe that. Anyone who uses language should believe that. A salesman, anyone. That this language I use is going to become flesh. It's not just words. It's a part of the structure of the reality of the person. And so they use their language in this way. We have a good model, I think, in our own Bible. When you use language in this respect, you realize that language is used in different ways for different purposes. Part of our big theological debate is simply because we have forgotten that. When I read a science textbook, I don't expect to read a book on poetry. When I read a book on poetry, I don't expect to read a science textbook. When I read a historical journal, I don't expect to read a historical novel. Every kind of literature is designed to communicate a certain aspect of reality, even mythology. Now, our Bible is quite aware of that, and it comes to us with language used in all these different ways, but all for the same purpose: to communicate something that's really real. Part of our debate is that we have assumed that Genesis was a science textbook. It is not. It's an epic poem. Or we have assumed that all of the Old Testament is a historical textbook, chronologically written, and it is not. Or we've assumed that the Gospels are infallible chronological life biographies, and they are not. Or we've assumed that the epistles of Paul are moral rules laid down for conduct, and they are not. There's a higher reality lying behind all of this. And once we learn this about language, the reality becomes more clear and more biting. For instance, you all like the Psalms. And I would suggest that one of the reasons you like the Psalms is that because they are not precise, not definitive, not historical, not scientific, even though you don't grasp the full dimension, you feel it. That which you feel is reality. The psalm is pointing to something else. The presence of God everywhere. Or the love of God in all conditions, or something of that sort of indescribable dimension. Now, the Hebrew poets had a way of doing that. And many of you have heard this, you know, and probably paid little attention to it, but I've kind of made a restudy of it, and it's helped me read the Psalms. This little business of serial parallelism of lines. For instance, the psalm, "Thy word," 119, 105, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." Now that's a poem. It's a poem because the focal point of it is the word. "Thy word is these things." But more than that, you see. Robert Frost has a beautiful little paragraph in which he writes about how a poem means. Not what a poem means or why it, but how a poem means. A poem, he said, means in the silences, not in the words. And he's got two lines of a poem that goes follows from his poem "The Span of Life." "The old dog barks backward without getting up. I can remember when she was a pup." That's corny poetry, but it's poetry. "The old dog barks backward without getting up." That's a descriptive sentence. He's here an observer, relating something he sees and hears. I can remember when she was a pup. This also is a descriptive sentence. The two together become more than the collection of the two, something quite else. And that other is in the pause between the two lines. His old dog barks backward without getting up. My dog is getting old. I can remember when she was a pup. Boy, it seems like just yesterday. Life is short. It's nothing. I wonder what happened to me in those span of years. I wonder where my life is going. A whole new world is in that silence. That's reality. We live in the day that thinks it's addicted to empirical evidence, wants to test everything empirically, against which the hippies are our dramatic protest. They're saying, okay, test us empirically. Have you ever been in a debate with a young couple getting married and found that really what you're discussing with them are the economic facts by which you survived life? And they don't like your economic facts. They want to do it a different way. And in the debate, you begin to color these economic facts with religious moralisms. And you begin to distort everything. And so you've lost reality. The reality is elsewhere, as they are really saying. Now, the Bible has always known this. That's why the Bible was a shock, a scandal, a different thing. Never letting us settle down for just this. Now, a poem can't mean anything unless it's related to fact. Now, getting back to Psalm 119, 105, thy word is a lamp unto my feet, a light unto my path. You know, that would be meaningless in a science book. Oxygen relights a glowing splint and produces flame from a smoldering ember. You'd think, what a lousy writer. Why did he say the same thing twice? And you would have been right in saying that, because the science writer was not writing poetry. He was writing a fact. But looking at this fact from different angles produces a new fact. And that reality is something that commends itself, says the Bible, to faith. Faith is not, I grew up hearing this a lot in college and I knew I didn't like it and I like it less now. Faith is not believing in spite of the evidence. That's irrationality. Faith is believing beyond the evidence. And to get beyond the evidence, you get more than evidence. You get evidence from all sides. And a good writer today is trying to clear the air at this point. A good poet is trying to clear the air at this point. Robert Frost does it beautifully in another poem. And I can't quote the poem, but it's, you know, Frost had trouble with faith, but he was always looking. And it's a poem describing his coming to a pool of water, a well, I think it was, a beautifully clear pool of water. And he says that he often came to this well and looked into it. And this gesture of looking into the well was symbolic. He was wondering if there was anything beyond what he saw. But he always saw only the water. And he says, one day I looked into the well and I saw something at the bottom, something white. It glistened a while, lay there. I looked away and when I looked back, it was gone. What did I see? A pebble? A mirage? A reflection? No. For once, I saw something. something. Faith sees that something and says, it's real. And it's this something, the presence of God, the love of God, the power of God, the reality of Christ, the reality of your neighbor, the reality of yourself, forgiveness, whatever you will. And lives by it. And this is the really real. And writers are trying to help us find this. Now, the Hebrew poets do this. I'm indebted to an English writer by the name of I.T. Ramsey. If any of you haven't discovered him, I commend him to you. There are three Ramseys writing today. It's terribly confusing. There's Paul Ramsey, who writes on ethics. There's I.A. Ramsey, who writes philosophical stuff and theological stuff. He's an Englishman. And there's Ian T. Ramsey, who also writes theological stuff, philosophical stuff, but with a little more, common flavor. I can understand him better. And if you want to read on this, he writes beautifully on how to read the parables, for instance, and Christianity and science, and conflict or synthesis, and so on. I.T. Ramsey. And he points out that the resurrection story in chapter 20 of John is a beautiful example of what I'm talking about. And it's the story, you know, of the women coming to the tomb. And I'll just read a few verses. Mary Magdalene had been there and saw that the tomb was empty. And she was so excited she ran and told Simon Peter and the other one, whom Jesus loved, we think it's John. They said they'd taken him out of the tomb. Peter then came out with the other disciple and they went toward the tomb. They both ran, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Now the point that Ian T. Ramsey brings out in this is that in these few verses, the word see is used three times, and in the original Greek, three different Greek words for see. Blepo, theoreo, and orao. And it's kind of unfair, you know, to bring Greek in here, but... And I'm no Greek scholar, for goodness sake. They both ran, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first, and stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, and that's the Greek word blepo, which means to notice. When I arrived in camp yesterday, I saw that this building was complete. The last time I was here, it was, you know, just a shambles. And so they had me lay some stone in the wall to say that I helped build this building. When I saw this building was complete, I blepoed the building. I just saw the building. It was completed. That's what Peter did. He blepoed the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there, and that was it. He didn't go in. That's all. Then Simon Peter came, following him. And he went into the tomb. He saw, the word is theoreo, he saw the linen cloths lying and the napkin which had been on his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. He saw with an eye for detail. He not only saw that the tomb was empty and the linen cloths were there, but he saw another interesting detail. He saw the napkin which had been on his head lying in a different place by itself. I get off the bus and I blepo the joint and then I theoreo the joint. I see that they really followed through on their plan and made this beautiful round fireplace in this room. Apparently, someone stuck it to the job or something of that sort. I see in detail that they did it. Nothing has transpired within me. My life hasn't changed, no great disclosure. I just see in more detail. Then the other disciple, who reached the tomb first, also went in. And he saw and believed. And the Greek word is orao, which encompasses the two seeing and believing, meaning seeing as believing, seeing beyond detail, seeing beyond fact, seeing with the eye of faith. Now these three words stand equal. The reality of orao is as real as the reality of theoreo or blepo. That which he saw, that Jesus is alive, was as real as what Peter saw. He wasn't here. The reality that faith grasps hold of is the sustaining reality of the Christian faith. And it's very interesting. It's built on fact and detail, but goes beyond it, you see. And from that time on, they didn't go around preaching, saying, when we went to the tomb, his head cloth was lying here, his linen cloth was lying here, and the tomb was empty. Now you've got to believe that. They went around saying, the tomb was empty. We don't know where he is. He is alive, and he is present. You believe that. That's as much fact as the other. It's this reality that lies in all of life that a good writer is trying to get at, that a good preacher is trying to probe, and above all, that the Christian tries to live by. Now, therefore, I've always welcomed all the demythologizing that comes my way. Like all of you, I know, in the development of my life, there has been a lot of interesting detail. Stuff connected with my prayer life that I really never shared with anybody. I believed it, but, you know, I'd hate to let you know I was that naive. Or that I really staked my life on. I couldn't go around saying, believe in Jesus, because once when one of my children was sick, I prayed my head off and then she became well again. I don't find that the fact. The fact is that when she was sick, I was able not to be bitter. That's a bigger fact. And to live in the confidence that God is love all the time, that's a fact. The Bible wants us to get to the ultimate reality, the presence of God in life, the love of God in life, the sustaining power of God in life. The fact that God is going to win, and it's going to be his way. And his way is love and forgiveness. And that's by faith. This is reality that the Bible is trying to portray. Now, to get to that kind of reality, you have to chop away a lot of stuff. Every generation accumulates its own barnacles. You younger people are going to have a whole basket full of barnacles. And you've got to get rid of them. You have to travel light. You have to live with what's real all the time, eliminating in order to find the greater and the more true. There's a whole school of contemporary fiction writers that have helped me in this. Graham Greene. If you haven't read The Power and the Glory, you know, it's a must. Graham Greene. Albert Camus, not a Christian. But I just read one of his short stories again before I came down here. Have you read The Exile in the Kingdom? Get at it. Flannery O'Connor is my current favorite. Have any of you read anything by Flannery O'Connor? She's a Southern writer. She's already dead. She died of lupus before she reached 40. And she's a Christian writer. She writes with all the boldness of the current generation, in which all her characters stand out in reds and purples and blacks and whites, you know, no pastel shades in her writing. And her favorite character is some kind of a nut, you know, a hillbilly, who seems to have an obsession with God. And she weaves phrases and stories around this crazy characters who have this distorted, crazy, violent, wild obsessions with God. And then things fall away, you see, and begin to see that there is a reality called faith. And we do this with our words, and we do this with our attitudes. We do this by being willing to let our age chop away from us that stuff that isn't necessary. The kind of religious baggage we carry around, you know, and think we have to protect. If I live by faith, I live a precarious life all the time. And I have to be thankful if someone is stripping me of proofs of God that never proved God, you know. Things of this sort. So if you want a place to start and aren't really acquainted, try the contemporary writers. And I don't mean the school that thinks that the whole world is made of sex. John Updike is one of my favorites until he wrote The Couples. And I just don't believe that even Updike was able to get as much out of pure sex as he tried. It just isn't quite that productive a field. I don't mean that, but I mean the way in which he used to use it, which was very close to the old Hebrew prophets, where sex was a kind of a symbol and was a part of life, but not all of life. And the way Graham Greene uses it is a part of life, but not all of life. Now these writers are looking for what's really real. I've got some more notes here, but it's about 10 minutes to the hour, and maybe I should quit and give us time. According to my watch, I guess there are two times, your watch and
what do you think?
The
door
will
be
down. The bell will ring, keep going.
Okay, what?
What do you think? The door will be down.
I don't know. Well, anyway, in this quest for reality, I want it clear that I'm not talking about certain schools of realism. I'm talking about a reality that posits God as a fact. Whether or not he can be demonstrated empirically, you see. I dare to believe that faith is a fact that latches on to God. Now, whether God is down there or up there or in there or under there, whether he actually exists apart from or is in or is the ground of our being, these really, I don't think, are the big questions. The big question is whether there is God. And the Bible has never fallen into that trap. The Bible just assumes God. And Jesus speaks of God as Father, to whom you relate in faith, or you don't find him ever anyway. The current writers are of many schools. There are certain ways in which they approach reality that I'd like to just talk about briefly. There are those that I call the exploiters of the real. I don't like them. The exploiters of the real act as though there is nothing really to life itself. They're the ones who say that reality is divorced from visible, definable existence. Like Proust, the French writer, he's got a passage that comes to mind, we love to drink the tea, not because we like the tea, but because it reminded us of pleasant hours we had together over the teacup years ago. Now that's a subtle way in which the exploiters of the real really say that what happens now is only important insofar as it points to something else which is reality. Now, the current school of writers, and I think they're right, I think they're biblical in that respect, never despise what is. They never exploit it to find something else. Reality is in the social turbulence, everything. It's here. See? That's what Jesus said. Look at them, he said, looked at the people. Look at them, fields white under harvest. Look at them. All he seemed to be doing with his disciples was to open their eyes and get them to notice, not to exploit. These are the kind of writers who look upon the world as a kind of a book of magical tricks, and in which you get ideas from, you see. Artists, songwriters, the same way. Then there is the psychologizer, who really is also exploiting the real, but in another way. And that is, after he sees what's real, he says the only thing that's real is what it means inside the individual. The exploiter of the real in the first place talks about something outside of existence. The psychologist wants to drive you deeper into your existence. And so it isn't, you know, the fact that we are sitting here together, but what does it really mean inside you right now, see? And how do you feel about it? Well, there was a preacher by the name of Schleiermacher, who was a great, great preacher 150 years ago or so, who really got us off on that track, I think, and hurt us as a church. If you read his sermons, which I've done, you discover that he has one pattern. He preaches the gospel beautifully. The test of the gospel after he's preached it is, how do you feel about it? Now, I find this very pertinent because I notice that the word feel is terribly prevalent today in common vocabulary. In other words, you can hear the gospel, Jesus died for your sins. That's not reality. The reality, according to this, is how you feel about it. So you go home and try to feel right about it. So you've shifted the basis of reality to something inside you which you manipulate. That's not reality. There are these psychologizers. And then there are the facers of the facts school. You know, a fact is a fact, a rose is a rose, a rose is a rose, and that's all there is, and we put them down, and, you know, do what you can. And then there are the writers like Graham Greene, whom I love, and Flannery O'Connor, and I don't know where to put Albert Camus because he doesn't profess to be a Christian. He's a facer of the fact, but you know, he tells you that he wrote his novels without God, hoping that the first word you would say after you read it was God. You don't really know what was in Camus' mind. He makes me look at God. And John Updike in much of his writings, until he wrote The Couples, and so on. These writers are really grappling with issues like this. Kafka, on a different level, and so on. And what I'm really only concerned about is that the church speak a real language, that Jesus emerges real, forgiveness is real, brotherhood is real, there is victory in Christ, it's real stuff, God is, you know, and that this reality commends itself to faith, and that your and my language and life may at that point really be rooted in reality. I guess, really, this reality is evident in lives that have grappled. And I have the good fortune of having a father who lived as if, as if Jesus were alive. And this made quite a difference in his life. I fought with him, argued with him, there was tension. But as I looked back, the thing that really was bugging me was that I couldn't shake the inescapable feeling that he lived really by one primary consideration. And that was that if Jesus Christ is Lord, my life ought to reflect it. And so he was struggling with it. That's what matters. It isn't whether you do it right or wrong. It is whether reality has really come into our lives in the form of Jesus Christ. Now, this is just a kind of a cursory introduction to what, if I have any more of these sessions, I'll expand on. That's it.
Are you suggesting that there is some reality that is inflexible and doesn't change, other reality does change? Are you making that distinction? Or are you just saying that there are certain realities that we could equate with truth?
If I were pinned down, really, I would say that there is reality that is always present. Whether it's changeless or changing is something I don't really know how to answer. I'm scared of it because I think it posits two crazy things. The reality, as I see, is God in Christ always in every person's life, which is therefore always fluid. See, always fluid.
Reality, a fluid situation.
Yeah.
Unchangeable.
Yeah, yeah, always fluid. Yeah. I'm really scared of saying reality is, you know, this solid thing here, a body of doctrine or statements or something or other.
Instinct sort of tells us you can't say that.
Yeah. Well, the gospel says that too.
Well, that's other things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is the Platonic idea of reality, is that valid?
I don't think it's live enough. It isn't created. The reality that Scripture talks about is not only something that exists, but is life-creating all the time.
Dynamic.
Always making new, breaking down, making new, life force all the time, recreating. The reality of the Bible is the new life, always.
Who are some of these psychological providers that...
What's his name? Begins with Fitz. Fitzgerald is the best of the lot. And then he spawned a lot of satellites who, you know, until eventually... I think the psychological novel just ran out of gas, you know, because all you were doing was looking inside forever and ever, you see. And it's rather interesting that things move like they do, that social involvement today has even entered the counseling and the psychology fields. So that counselors and psychologists today are saying that it isn't just a matter of, you know, one man and his problems. It's always now a man in relationship to, you see, trying to get out of that pit. Well, he's the ultimate. No, he's great.
Yeah, he's great. But he's definitely psychological.
Yeah, yeah, but he doesn't look for the solution inside. The solution always lies outside the man, you see. Yeah, in relationship. That's the point. That's the subtle distinction, yeah. No, he's the greatest of all. Actually, he's the father of the whole school of quest for reality in writers. He's the...
question I wanted to ask, and that's that I think the way in which this reality breaks through us is in a community. And that's what I think is missing from the proclamation so much, is that the community isn't supporting it. I mean, the congregation seems like a conglomeration. Back when we were a tribe and a hyphenated American, there was a continual community that was warm and live and real. It was supporting and embracing this, you know. And we don't seem to have been able to find the transition from tribe to church, as far as I can see. No.
I think you're right. But I think we're in a period in which a lot of the old things that formed community are breaking down, and I think right now we're just desperately looking, you know, because community seems to have some supportive stuff in culture.
Well, like one critic said about all these men, you've been talking about a number of others, that the whole quest of the 20th century literature is a search for the church.
Yes, it is.
And when you realize that's what it is, and that's what makes Holden take. Mm-hmm. And our whole problem is how to allow Holden to happen in every parish, so that there's a sense of a live sense of one another, and the excitement of the mystery of one another, and the realization of the acceptance and support of one another, black or white or poor or rich and so on.
Yeah.
This is where it seems to me that it's so kind of dull and dead.
Well, I would kind of hope that out of this whole thing that the church is able to really create a new form of Christian community that isn't so totally dependent on the culture form, you know. That if there's another revolution, it'll also smash up again, you see.
Wasn't the old community more really closed and embowed, and the new community should be more open?
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
You can still find this, for instance, amongst certain of the Finnish groups. They've got, oh boy, you go into one of their saunas and they greet you with God's peace as you come in, God's peace you leave, and the rosy, relaxed, warm acceptance of each other. But it doesn't go any further than that. You aren't Finns. God help you. No.
I preached in a church in St. Paul during Lent. Some of you know Arthur Johnson, the sociologist at the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And he belongs to that church. I didn't know that. I was trying to warm the church up. I felt it was kind of cold. So I thought, well, you begin where people are, you know. And I suggested in the course of the sermon that they take their community seriously enough to call each other on the phone and share a Christian thought, you know, and so on and so on. And I was really feeling good because they liked that, see, and they just, oh man, I could see they were swallowing it up. And Art met me at the door, he said. Well, the sermon was good, but why did you tell them to do that? That's all they ever do. I'm trying to get them to remember they live in St. Paul. Yeah, so there you had a really kind of a, you'd call it a warm community, but it was closed, you see. There's no openness.
See, the Christians are this way in Norway, and Kosli is their big word. They're this way in Denmark, Higley is their big word. I mean, they're cozy and comfortable. They got a wonderful humor together. There's a real sense of one another. But the minute you break outside this established sort of style of piety that they've got, they can't even talk. Honestly, they're scared to death. They're calling their neighbor who isn't a believer.
They're lost.
No, they're lost. They don't have a conversation. And this, at least, we have destroyed with destroying that old tribe, but we haven't captured it.
No.
We have a vital sense of open community, as you say here.
We
have to be authentic. We have to receive each other. There has to be a real sense of, we might say, in sense here, but an in sense that doesn't end with that. I think that's what we're facing today as churches, our number one problem. I mean, it's a style, what we call piety in the old days. How do we find a style of open? I just wrote a Christmas letter to the Celebrate Christmas here, and I wrote it to our whole constituency, and I just said, invite somebody who isn't going to invite you back for a picnic or something as our little Christmas suggestion from Holden. Let the community in on it. Invite an older person who's just neglected, or a young adult who's not going to be invited out, or a black, or an Indian, out for a family picnic.
Theologically, I think the open door is the person of Christ. if you, you know, go outside your closed community and start to talk theologically, you find that it really is very little common language anywhere. But I'm really impressed with the fact that everywhere they can't leave him alone, you know? And I really don't care whether they have my theological definition. If they can't leave him alone, it's a tremendous starting point. And if we could make, you know, here, probably is what God intended all along anyway, is where community, you know, really can begin.
Isn't there such a thing as finding the reality of God by, like Hindley said, by being involved, by doing?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking of Bonhoeffer's proposition. It just doesn't, we just don't sit and God does it all.
Oh, no. No. Heavens no. No.
The problem is worldwide, and that's the thing that confronts us at this moment. Now, Pacey, which is a community similar to this in some senses, makes everybody come promise that they'll invite someone into their home every month. They'll never invite them back, that they wouldn't ordinarily do so except for Jesus Christ. Just to break through with hospitality into this community-forming thing. Well, where does community start? You know, Matthew throws a supper, invites in all the other publicans, you know. How does this break through its normal patterns that have gotten dull for us and boring? I mean, congregational activity, is there, you know, the excitement there is gone. Maintain a church in a corner. I've suggested everywhere we build saunas and have a Saturday night open house for the whole neighborhood. They don't have no one to sit up, one to sit down, everybody gets a backdrop. Pagans are welcome. Well, we do have to teach the world to relax. We really do. I think we have to teach the world how to enjoy the world. I think this is one of the functions of the church. They really don't know how.
Well, the great move on secularization is not evil. You know, it's helping us see the, and Bonhoeffer points that out, you know, that the glory of God is in all the details of human life.
He even,
you know,
goes so far as to say that pleasure is not only an end in itself, it's a means to an end, it's an end in itself.
Can be, yeah.
Bodily pleasure.
Yeah. He doesn't ride that one very hard, though.
No, but he said it.
Yeah. Well,
thank you, Arne.
That's a strange question, because Job knew where to look for God.